Continue on with this nice solid theme we have going. Our next speaker is Jennifer Moore Casera. Got it. She's I can read the slide. Help me here. She's at Texas Tech. She's been looking at biology. She's looking at the soil soil microbe interaction with specific interest in carbon nitrogen transformations as impacted by management decisions. So with that, it's another connection talk. So I think we're interested in hearing this.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Ron and Veronica, for the invitation to come today and talk with you about some of the research that's been going on in my lab at Texas Tech. The title is Connecting Soil Microbial Communities to Soil Functioning and Soil Health. And so soil health is a resurgence in identifying the importance of soil biology specifically to enhance ecosystem services. And the general concept that we work under in my lab is that by choosing management practices that increase the amount, types, and availability of the above ground contribution, the plant residues, and by minimizing disturbances, it all starts with a transformation and change in the numbers and types of soil organisms. And if we adopt these practices and increase soil diversity and richness, that translates into the transformation of organic matter, part of which is release of CO2 into our atmosphere, but another component under the right set of conditions is the buildup of stable organic matter, or humus. This, therefore, has the ecological function, or ecosystem service, of sequestering carbon, long-term pools, and mitigating climate change. By increasing organic matter via the shifts of microbial populations, we increase aggregate stability, and the ecosystem services that stem from this are the resistance to the erosive forces of wind and water, wind being a dominant form of erosion in our area of the Southern High Plains. By increasing aggregate stability and increasing the contribution or buildup of humus, we also increase water infiltration storage and therefore enhance water and air quality. These transformations work together to enhance biogeochemical cycling and the release of plant available nutrients. And all of these work synergistically together, therefore, to create a healthy plant productive system that can sustain the local economy. In the Southern High Plains, those are a great couple of slides. Thank you for introducing our area. We're actually located in Lubbock, and in our area, cotton's a very important crop. We produce over 60% of the nation's cotton in this area. However, from a soil health perspective, it's probably not the best choice, and that coupled with some abiotic variables gives us a lot of ecological challenges to soil resilience in this environment. The abiotic variables include our depleted water source, the Ogallala Aquifer, which is being extracted more rapidly than it's being recharged. We're in a semi-arid environment that's prone to drought, and as the previous speaker already alluded to, extreme weather events, drought, floods, heat, et cetera. And our soils are inherently susceptible to wind erosion with a wind erodibility index of over 200 tons per hectare per year. And as I mentioned, the dominant crop is cotton, which is economically very important, but it's also a very high disturbance agronomic system that typically relies on intensive frequent tillage. It's low diversity. Sometimes they'll rotate with sorghum or millet. Long fallow periods and low residue return. So there are some management practices, though, that we can adopt and we have been working on that have been shown to enhance overall soil health and combat soil degradation, again, in the form of wind erosion in our area of the Southern High Plains. Of course, we can do this by increasing plant residues that are returned to the soil via the adoption of crop rotations. And then I will give some examples of how integrating cattle into the cropping system, or ICLs, as they're sometimes referred to, often converts part of the land, sometimes not even all of it, into perennial grasslands or forage lands. We can adopt or convert to conservation or no-till practices. In the Southern High Plains, these are a little bit slow in coming, but we are working concurrently on a few projects where we're investigating no-till cotton wheat systems. And finally, another option is to enroll in conservation management programs supported by the government. today I'd like to give you two examples and two very contrasting soil types. The first one is in a clay loam system where the primary management strategy is to integrate cattle into the cropping system. And then the second one is in our CRP restoration program study, and this is on a fine sandy loam. And in this system, we're converting our highly erodible soils into perennial grasslands under the CRP. So in the first set, the integration of cattle into the cropping systems, what's nice about these systems that were really spearheaded by Dr. Vivian Allen over 15 years ago at Texas Tech, is to convert part or all of the system into either perennial grasslands or a rotation that integrates a forage crop into the overall system. And what's nice is that the farmer can split their fields to appropriate higher quality water, or if they don't have enough irrigation water, they can support a row crop, such as this farmer in corn, and then the remaining half of his field is under old world bluestem grasslands. This increases the plant diversity, the plant residues. It's more efficient, been shown to take up less nutrients and obviously water. It reduces overall risk by diversifying their cropping system portfolio. And the cattle then, when they're grazing this area, return nutrients and biota to the system. And at least in this case, half of the field is protected in the soil by this perennial grassland. This soil is a Pullman clay loam. It's an alkaline of on average 7.7 pH and about 30% clay content. So what is the impact of these integrated crop livestock systems on one of our measures of microbial community shifts, and that's the fungal to bacteria ratio? And what was really interesting about this study is that it actually depends on the ratio that impacts the interpretation. What do I mean by that? Is that in general, we look at the fungal, the 18-2 omega-6-9, and this is based on fatty acid methylester profiling in regards to the bacteria component. And in these systems, we actually found the highest fungal-to-bacteria ratio under the monoculture cotton system, and much lower ratios and little to no statistical differences between the various ICLs, whether we had rotations, perennial dryland, or a mixture of perennial and row crop systems. However, if we look at the marker for arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, we actually saw the complete opposite trend, where the monoculture cotton had the lowest AMF to bacteria ratio, followed by the rotations and the perennial systems. AMF, especially in our environment, again, these alkaline dryland systems, is very important for helping those plants take up and enhance their nutrient and water uptake. And under our alkaline conditions, it's very important for phosphorus uptake. So we also looked at the shift of management on microbial richness and diversity, and for this we used 454 high-throughput sequencing techniques. And what we found was that by converting part or all of the field to rotation or these perennial-based agroecosystems, we increased fungal richness almost fourfold. This is based on the entire system area, so whether you're only on a monoculture cotton or you're splitting the system into perennial grasslands and row crops, the monoculture cotton supported about 400 OTUs from the fungal perspective and up to 1,600 in the rotations or perennial systems. By increasing the fungal richness, this translated into a significant increase in organic matter content, again associated with that initial shift of management, but we're changing the community, and the community is imparting these ecosystem benefits. It's not the other way around. And so we found significant correlations, positive correlations, with increasing richness and increasing organic matter accrual. We also found that increasing fungal richness was significantly correlated with the mean weight diameter, and this is often used as an indication of aggregate stability, again, important to resist erosion. And specifically, what was interesting is that different orders of fungi, in this case the Heliotiales, was significantly correlated with that measure of aggregate stability as well. And so what we're trying to do is link these changes in microbial communities to ecosystem benefits. Oftentimes, These studies are done independent of one another, and in fact, this work hasn't been published yet because it was done partly by one PhD student, Dr. Davinick, who is the molecular biologist on the project, and Dr. Lisa Fultz, which was the biochemist on the project. And so now it's coming. We need to come back together and take these two pieces of chemistry and microbiology and try to relate them. And so that was exciting, and we're looking forward to publishing that soon. So in overall, the soil fungal richness plays a critical role in formation of soil stable aggregates. And this is proposed in the literature, but we're actually showing direct evidence of that with our data and specific taxa. And how do these shifts in microbial groups influence nutrient cycling? Well, in general, as we increase microbial biomass, we increase enzymatic activity in the release of nutrients. But we're able to associate specific groups of both fungal and bacterial taxa to the release of available soil phosphorus in the soil. And in this case, these are Malic-3 extractions. So the microbial community composition and shifts in different taxa are influencing the release of plant available nutrients. So in summary, in our clay loam study of the integrated crop livestock systems, by including crop rotations or perennial paddocks in the rotation, we've shown that we can increase microbial richness that translated into the benefit of increasing organic matter content and carbon sequestration. We increase aggregate stability, increasing our ability to resist erosion, and we enhance nutrient cycling specifically via the release of phosphorus in these alkaline, low phosphorus soils. But what happens? Oftentimes you get, okay, well, that's a clay loam soil. We know that the inherent soil properties play an important role in driving ecosystem benefits. And so our second question was to relate it in a totally different management system, but now let's look at increasing crop residues at above ground biodiversity, and how does that translate into the impact on microbial dynamics and ecosystem functioning in a sandy loam. So for this is, we looked at enrolling land in CRP, and we found various fields that had been enrolled in CRP for different amounts of time. Our young fields were from 6 to 15 years restored, the old fields 20 to 26 years, and then we qualitatively compared them to rangeland soils that had never been cropped or farmed. And again, this is a fine sandy loam soil, again alkaline, but now we have 71% sand and half as much clay coming in on average of 17%. We sampled 26 different fields across 7 counties in the Southern High Plains region for this portion. And this is kind of the model that we're looking under. This is based on a publication in Soil Heavy Metals. But it illustrates the same concept. And in our case, our original ecosystem was the short grass prairie. And our ecosystem disturbance in this case is long-term intensive monoculture cropping. And the goal of the CRP then is to, we're not expecting to get back to that original ecosystem. I'm not even sure how to measure if we can even get there since that's changing as with time in place. But can we replace that system on an equally functioning level? And that's the whole goal of a conservation reserve program. So what we found, and this is looking at the bacterial diversity, and this is based on another technique of high-throughput sequencing, aluminum iSeq platform. And what we found on the left-hand side is that the cropland samples were distinct from all of the different grassland samples, whether you were young, old, or in long-term rangeland production. And within those different restoration periods, there was no significant difference in bacterial composition. However, there was a difference in a shift of population of bacterial of higher carbon affinity in the grasslands. The croplands were identified by taxa that were copiotrophic in nature, and there are low carbon affinity, such as Nitrosphaera, Bacteroidetes, and certain members of proteobacteria. And in contrast, the grassland sites were dominated by oligotrophic type taxa, which have high carbon affinity, such as Acetobacteria, Rubrobacteria, and Planktomycetes. We also found that there was a significant shift in population due in the fungal community. Again, on the right-hand side now is the cropland, shown in gold, and then green is young, blue is old, and purple is the rangeland. For fungi, we actually saw a significant shift in, or a distinction, sorry, between the young and the old sites in contrast to the bacteria, indicating that soil fungi might be a more sensitive indicator of these management practices. The cropland sites were dominated by taxa that are general litter decomposers, and although we didn't go to species level with this type of sequencing, we did find members that have been known with associations of pathogenic in nature, and so it's something that we can watch for moving forward in the future. The grasslands were dominated by fungi that are known to be lignin decomposers, so important in breaking down those recalcitrant components of organic matter into stable humus. Various members of mycorrhizal species, and also these dark septate fungi, which have resistance to the strong UV radiation in our area. And many of these members are known to be phosphorus solubilizers. Again, this is very important in our alkaline soils where the phosphorus is typically bound to calcium. And we also, similar to the study in the clay loam, in the sandy loam, we did see increasing fungal richness was associated with increasing organic carbon content. But notice we're still less than 1% organic carbon, so we still have a long ways to go. And again, I'm not sure after years and years of erosion if we can ever reach those levels of the native prairie. But we'll keep trying. And then we were also excited to see that different taxa, specifically in this case some bacterial groups, the verrucomicrobia and planktomycetes, were positively associated with the accrual of organic matter over the sampling scheme. And so that was one part where we've shown that by shifting from intensive agricultural system to these conservation reserve programs, we are enhancing various components of soil health, specifically microbial diversity, organic matter accrual, and nutrient cycling. But these contracts expire, and the question is, what happens when these contracts expire and now we redisturb the system? What level of ecosystem functioning will we be achieving? And this is a kind of a new model that my student literally within the last couple of weeks put together, and she'll be presenting that material. It's Chengwei Li's presentation on Wednesday at 1:35 in room 101I. You can get more details about it. But what we're looking at is sometimes enzyme activities go up, sometimes they go down, sometimes various components don't all match up together. And so what she's trying to do is to put it all together in some sort of a proposed model. And so in this case, we're looking at the response of what we're terming dynamic carbon properties following an ecological disturbance, such as CRP conversion to cropland. And the idea is the DCPs, the first one is the particular organic matter pool, labile organic matter. And our idea is that it should increase rather quickly because we're converting all that grassland root biomass, we're tilling it under and we're chopping it up and we're exposing it. There should be a release of that pool, followed by a release in the microbial biomass. And then she has the specific microbial activities, which is the ratio of enzyme activity to microbial biomass carbon and or the release of CO2 per unit biomass. And these are a little bit interesting. They're often reported as stress indicators, but they're not always an indicator of stress. You have to kind of piece it together with these various pools, particular organic matter, microbial biomass. If you increase a huge flux of nutrients and carbon resources to the system, they're going to respond very rapidly, and it might take a while for the biomass to catch up with them. And so we kind of group this into a growth phase, a maintenance phase, and then a stress phase. And then we have two different depths, three she'll talk about, where they kind of fall out in the first year is here in this sort of maintenance period where we saw a significant increase of microbial biomass compared to the CRP of over 26%. No change in the labile organic matter pool, and these sites had been converted about 1 to 2 years before our sampling. And so we think we missed that pool, that flush, and we're picking up the lag with the microbial biomass. And then a decrease in the specific enzyme activity following that rapid depletion of organic material. And this is in our first year of sampling in 2011. And then In 2012 and 2013, all of the points kind of align themselves with the stress area where death is presumably exceeding reproduction with extremely low microbial biomass, particular organic matter content, but very high enzyme activity. And in this case, because it's coupled with these declines in the labile pools, we're associating that ratio with stress. What's interesting at the second depth, and that's where most of that organic matter is tilled under and stored, is that all 3 years of sampling, we saw very high levels of microbial biomass, particulate organic matter, and the specific activities, indicating that at least for the 3 years that we've sampled, that's a positive attribute of it. But the hypothesis is that it's going to be pretty short-lived, and within a few more years, it will be rapidly depleted. Again, we're talking less than 1% carbon and high temperatures, and with a little bit of rain, those materials are presumably will be released. So in summary, by adopting management practices that increase the quantity and or diversity of the above ground system, we positively have altered that microbial richness and diversity. And with specific members of the microbial community that are linked to positive impacts on soil attributes of ecological significance, specifically increased organic matter content, enhanced aggregate stability, the release of plant available nutrients, the potential to sequester carbon, especially in our clay loams compared to our sandy loams. But it still begs the question, do these attributes translate into ecosystem resilience? What happens under extreme drought and extreme temperature events? And I believe our next speaker, Dr. Costa Martinez, will touch on that a bit. But with that, I'd like to thank my co-PIs on this, and this is just the short list of the individuals, and my former students, Dr. Lisa Foltz, Dr. Marco Davinic, Dr. Mamata Kakarla, and Cheng Hui Li, a PhD candidate working in my lab, and of course our funding sources through the USDA and Southern SARE programs. With that, I thank you for your attention and welcome any questions you may have. Converting back to cropland, or in the other one? Well, that's what the literature suggests. We haven't studied that specifically in the Southern High Plains. Like I mentioned, it's a little slow to be adopted, but we currently have a program where we're looking at no-till strategies with cotton and wheat and sorghum, so we should have those data in a couple of years to share with you, but in general, in other parts of the U.S., that definitely is supported. Mm-hmm. Say yes, too. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, how did you measure the fungi bacteria ratio?
The one I started with in the beginning, that was based on fatty acid methyl ester profiles. So different ratios, the 18-2 omega-6-9 is often a saprophytic type of fungi, whereas the 16-1 is our vascular mycorrhizal marker. And so depending which ratio you use, you're giving a different interpretation of the management shift. So are you supporting more saprophytic fungi, and that would be supported by these very low carbon systems if we increase carbon residues from the breakdown of the cotton, we would support a higher saprophytic, but in the perennial systems with less disturbance, we're supporting more of the vascular mycorrhizal fungi, which might be a little bit more sensitive to tillage operations. So they're higher in those lower disturbed perennial systems. But we also, just aside the fungal to bacteria ratio, we can use our OTU numbers, and we've looked at that to increase the fungal to bacteria ratio under different management practices from a sequencing perspective. I guess in the back.
When you see a particular association between a microbial tecton and the soil organic matter, what do you think the direction of causality is there?
Well, question, right? But that's kind of where, if we can have multiple lines of evidence that suggests that as we shift from one group of microbial taxa, fungi, or bacteria, and we see an increase in organic matter, right? Organic matter just doesn't materialize out of thin air. So my kind of approach is, well, we're increasing and we're shifting who's breaking down that material. And if we can try to identify specific taxa, then we can follow up with other studies that more specifically target that or use a meta-analysis across different regions and try to see what other individuals are studying. What's kind of unique about our approach is that we go at it from both directions, where, as I mentioned, it's often such isolated studies of just sequencing data or just organic matter data. And what we're trying to do is propose, here are some things we're finding, kind of throw it out there and see what the other researchers in other regions are finding. But it's definitely a question that we toss around back and forth a lot in our discussions. I don't know is the short answer, but I know it starts with the microbes. That I know.